Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Stephanie Adraktis, and I represent the petitioner Earl Dixie. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time.
Okay.
Dixie is serving a sentence of 25 years to life based on a conviction for evading the police, a wobbler offense that can be charged as a misdemeanor under California law. Under California law, that offense now can no longer subject a defendant to a sentence of more than 3 years. Dixie's trial counsel was prejudicially ineffective because she failed to conduct a reasonable investigation into his diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia, and she also failed to present a defense based on his mental health at trial. The Riverside County Superior Court unreasonably applied Strickland and Wiggins, which require that counsel conduct a reasonable investigation prior to preparing a defense.
How do we know she didn't? I don't know.
Mr. Dixie's statements are the evidence that we have in the record. He states that no expert ever met with him or evaluated him. And we also know that from trial counsel's statements during closing argument where she told the jury, hey, there could have been a better defense here based on mental health and schizophrenia, but that's not in front of you. So we know that she bypassed that defense and that Mr. Dixie was never evaluated.
Is there anything in the record that suggests that that defense, that illness, would have caused him, would have disenabled him from developing the intent to commit the crime?
Your Honor, what we do have are the prison medical records that Mr. Dixie attached to his state petitions, and they do make reference to visual and auditory hallucinations and the fact that he's paranoid and that he suffered from these symptoms for a long time.
No, that deals with the issue of whether he had schizophrenia. Is there anything in the record that would suggest that this prevented him from forming the intent to escape from the police when he saw them walking towards his car, and then he took off at 100 miles an hour? He testified himself that he wasn't suffering from any of those symptoms that you've just described.
Well, Your Honor, he testified that he, right before he fled from the police, the thought that was in his mind was that he wanted to go home, and that he then had no memory of fleeing from the police, and the next thing he remembered was waking up in the hospital.
I know, but Black...
Except he went through, I mean, you have pretty low burdens on the type of intent that you have to have on the activities that were involved, because essentially you have ingesting substances, drove a motor vehicle, police approached his car, at which time he began what eventually became a high-speed chase, reaching 100 miles an hour, crashing through fences, struck palm trees, ran red lights, drove on the wrong side of the road, and more before he came to a halt, he damaged his vehicle. You know, he was convicted at trial of evading the police as well as several misdemeanors, and he had prior convictions under 3 strikes. Okay. So, and plus... If it would be doubly bad news, you're under AEDPA, which has a doubly deferential standard of review, which is what's your strongest case supporting a grant of relief on Dixie's IAC claim?
Your Honor, it's based on counsel's failure to investigate at all when she did know that Mr. Dixie suffered from schizophrenia and when she was attempting to present a mental defense at trial. And when her arguments to the jury demonstrate without question that she misapprehended the law that she was trying to persuade the jury to apply. She told the jurors, because Mr. Dixie was intoxicated, his actions were not less criminal. That is incorrect.
And is there any affidavit from counsel in the lower court?
There is not, Your Honor. She did not supply an affidavit.
All right. That's problematic.
It's problematic. You're
speculating.
Did you try and get one from her? I'm sorry, did you represent the petitioner?
I did not represent him in the federal district court. He was pro se, Your Honor, in the district court. So we couldn't add a new declaration in the appeal. But we do know from counsel's statements to the jury what she was thinking, because she thought that she could persuade them to acquit him just because he was drunk and because he'd taken drugs, which is absolutely wrong.
I think what her argument was that if he wanted to make up a story, a better story would have been that he was schizophrenic. But he testified that he was high.
The troubling thing about her statement, though, is her acknowledgement of the fact that it's a better defense to the jury. This is bizarre, dangerous behavior.
We don't know. It may or may not have been a better defense.
It's hard to imagine an expert witness, one who understands schizophrenia and who understands psychiatric illness, who would not have been able to explain to the jury that Mr. Dixie, unlike a person who doesn't suffer from schizophrenia, would have been.
But what do you have to? But to commit the to be convicted of the crimes that he was convicted of, these are not. They're not. They don't require a lot of mental acuity. I mean, in terms of. Like, you see a police car and you take off at 100 miles an hour. You ingest drugs and there isn't any specific intent under there that you have to know that that would have caused you to be driving under the influence. You don't have to know any of that. You're under the influence.
We're not contesting the under the influence conviction. It's only the evading the police, which was the only felony. And the prosecutor did have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that he had the specific intent to evade the police. When you look at the facts,
but then all for that you need to know is it's a police car and they're in police uniforms. It's not rocket science. It's not like you have to know the police manual.
It's not. But what we have here is a very particularly acute situation. A person who was profoundly grieved by his, essentially adopted daughter's recent death. Somebody who had taken PCP, which even the state's expert said can cause a dissociative state almost immediately. And then when you add to that a chronic, severe, and disabling illness like schizophrenia, it presents a different issue for the jury than just saying that he was high. And that's the troubling issue here, that a juror listening to these very bizarre,
saying she didn't make a good argument for juror nullification? I don't think IAC requires investigation for juror nullification. It requires putting defenses on, right?
Not suggesting that the jury, that she was trying to get them to nullify or that she should have done that, but the jurors should have been fully informed about Mr. Dixie's mental health in order to make a fair judgment about whether the prosecutor had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he actually formed with the intent to evade the police. And because they didn't receive that information, they didn't hear from a defense expert who could have explained to them about Mr. Dixie's very long-standing serious mental illness.
It's your position that a mental health expert would have testified that he was incapable of performing the intent to evade the police?
Your Honor, because an expert did not evaluate him, because the defense counsel didn't do the investigation that she should have done, we don't have access to that expert testimony. And I realize respondent discusses that at length in his brief. Mr. Dixie is indigent. He didn't have the thousands of dollars it would have taken to hire an expert post-conviction to do that evaluation for him. That's
you
why
wanna save,
Wiggins...
You want to save your balance for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your
Honor. Okay, thanks.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, California Deputy Attorney General Daniel Hilton for respondent. This Court's questions really cut to the heart of the matter here. First, we have no declaration from counsel, so it's very well possible that counsel did do some preliminary investigation and then determined that further investigation was unnecessary, especially...
He was pro se in the district court, wasn't he?
Yes.
Was he pro se in the district court?
Yes, he was pro se.
So he failed to provide an affidavit.
Correct.
Do we give that any weight if he's pro se?
Well, Your Honor, not only did he not submit an affidavit, but he didn't submit an affidavit from himself saying that he was unable to reach counsel or that he didn't have the resources to do so. So it doesn't appear that he made any effort. There's nothing in the record suggesting he made any effort to contact counsel or an expert. And because it's possible that counsel did make efforts, that supports the argument that this really was a tactical decision. And in closing arguments, counsel went through the different arguments they could have ran and said, no, we're going with this argument because we think it's the truth and we think it's the strongest.
Did you make any effort? I know it's not uncommon, at least in New York, in the Eastern District, and possibly in the Second Circuit, to get an affidavit from the to ask the lawyer who represented the defendant at trial for the affidavit, saying this is what your client says happened. Did it happen, and why not?
Yeah, it's very common, Your Honor. The last case I argued here did have an affidavit from counsel, and they are often provided. And there was no indication that one was even sought in this case, let alone provided. But I think the more
important... But should that be your burden?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because in the state courts and also in the district court, it's a defendant that has the burden as the petitioner.
Yes, but of course he was pro se.
And he has mental issues.
Yes, Your Honors, but he could have...
He's an incarcerated pro se petitioner, has a limited ability to obtain expert evidence, and his IAC claim was that his own trial counsel failed to investigate his mental health issues and develop the record in that regard. Should the habeas court taken that into account when assessing whether or not the petitioner had met his burden?
No, Your
Honor. I mean, your eyes aren't supposed to light up when you have a pro se and say, like, yes.
Of course, Your Honor, you're correct. But in this case, certainly he didn't need to provide thousands of dollars for an expert, but he could have at least provided a declaration from himself, which would be the bare minimum, saying, I tried to contact an expert and I don't have the sufficient funds.
He didn't have to provide thousands of dollars. You could make a motion, and then a habeas petitioner could ask a district court to, under the statute, to appoint, for money to appoint or to appoint an expert. He doesn't need thousands of dollars.
Certainly, Your Honor. And one other thing I'd like to point out is, although he does suffer from schizophrenia, he had no trouble litigating this case both in state court and federal court. He filed four separate petitions pro per. So, and several of them were quite lengthy and supported with case law and with citations to the record. They weren't gibberish by any means.
So we know what the sort of the facts of the case were. So the record shows that trial counsel was aware of his schizophrenia, I think as petitioner's counsel has indicated, but never consulted with a mental health expert and never requested a mental health evaluation or even his mental health records. Why is that not deficient conduct in light of what the facts of this case were?
Well, Your Honor, appellant's argument is based on the assumption that counsel never conducted any research, but without an affidavit, we don't know that that's true. Counsel very well may have conducted some sort of informal preliminary investigation and then determined based on the facts it was unnecessary, because as this court's questions showed, the facts of the actual event itself, immediately before, during, and after the chase, all show that there was nothing having to do with schizophrenia that would have prevented appellant from forming specific intent, especially when we have him discarding the drugs right as the police arrive, pulling away, and then pulling over when the police initially pulled him over, showing that he understood and recognized that if the police turn on their lights, he has to pull over. Then he waited until the police got out of their car before taking off, which gave him the maximum amount of head start and the best chance of getting away. He then turned off his lights as it was evening, making him harder to detect. He drove at speeds up to 100 miles an hour, weaving in and out of traffic. And so all these facts show that he was not having hallucinations. He was not suffering from delusions or hearing auditory voices. And so even if he could establish deficient performance, he can't establish prejudice, because by his own testimony, there was nothing in this crime that had to do with his schizophrenia.
Let me ask you this. I think there's also an allegation, because he got 25 to life because of his prior convictions under three strikes, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how, I didn't ask, one case is Ewing versus California, which counsel did not talk about, and in that case, I guess that's where the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a 25 to life on much less aggravated. But then another case is Gonzalez v. Duncan, which is a Ninth Circuit case where Gonzalez appeared to have far more extensive and violent criminal history than Dixie's, yet we found the sentence under California's three strikes law grossly disproportionate.
Yes, Your Honor. So the two cases, the United States Supreme Court cases, Andrade and Ewing, both those cases involve very similar criminal history and less serious third offenses that weren't dangerous to the community. And both those cases involved wobblers, which in California are crimes that could be charged as a misdemeanor or a felony. And so those cases are directly on point here. The two cases relied on by appellant, which are Gonzalez v. Duncan and Ramirez v. Castro, which are Ninth Circuit cases, are highly distinguishable. In Gonzalez v. Duncan, the trigger crime that led to the sentence was failing to register as a sex offender when the defendant moved, and he had previously registered. And the district court indicated that it was concerned that the defendant had actually tried to register. And they described this offense as a mere regulatory offense that by itself poses no danger to society. And that's in contrast, of course, here where the defendant was driving at 100 miles an hour and nearly struck someone who was in the bicycle lane as he drove through residential neighborhoods. As for Ramirez v. Castro, in that case, the defendant had only two prior robberies his entire criminal history, and both were very minimal force was used, and one was an open-hand push, and the other he committed no act of violence, but his co-defendant did. And so in both of those cases, they're distinguishable by the first, the criminal history, and then second, the trigger offense.
So what is this defendant, Mr. Dixie's criminal history?
Yes, so he has 7 felonies, 6 misdemeanors. 7 of those felonies are strikes. They're robbery offenses, and all involve the use of violence. In one robbery, he bit someone. In another, he stabbed someone in the leg with a screwdriver. And in the third robbery, he pulled someone out of the car and sat on them. And when the police found him sitting on top of the victim while someone was rifling through their pockets. So given those or his prior offenses are more serious than certainly in Ramirez v. Castro, and they're very similar to Andrade and Ewing. And so we see that with that continuous criminal history where he had spent more than half of his adult life incarcerated. And one other thing I'd like to point out is that appellant was actually sentenced to 25 to life for his robbery offense, and then that conviction was reduced on appeal. So he already had the benefit of knowing that he was sentenced to 25 to life, getting a break, getting out of prison, and then within a short time later, he was again committing more felony-level offenses.
Okay. Anything else?
No, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, I would ask you to affirm the district court's judgment.
Oh, do you have a question? No additional questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Then rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court has asked whether there's any evidence that Mr. Dixie was suffering from a delusion at the time he was driving, but I would submit that the whole incident reflects delusional behavior because he had no significant reason to flee from the police, much less.
Well, he had drugs.
He had a very small amount of marijuana in the car and a small amount of gin, both misdemeanor conduct.
And he was under the influence.
And he was under the influence, which, again, is a misdemeanor, Your Honor. It's not something that would justify a person fleeing at 100 miles an hour.
Well, if he had hit the bicyclist, it could have been a second-degree murder.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But the point I'm trying to make is that it was delusional behavior because there wasn't a real reason for him to do this, and
the reason not to get caught?
Because, Your Honor,
he's doing 25 to life now. To get caught is pretty motivational.
For a misdemeanor, it comes up at trial, Your Honor, where trial counsel says, what do you think you could be sentenced to for having a small amount of marijuana or a gin in the car? It's a misdemeanor. He knows that that's very mild compared to his prior offenses and is not going to subject him to a prison sentence. So why would he flee in such a desperate and crazy way from the police unless he was suffering from some kind of a delusion at the time, especially in a 1978 Cadillac fleeing from a fleet of police vehicles and a helicopter? It just doesn't make any sense. And so there is evidence here that he was delusional at the time of the offense. It should have been evaluated by an expert. Often, also, as to the issue of trial counsel's declaration, frequently trial lawyers don't cooperate, and we don't know whether Dixie made a request of his trial lawyer or not.
Give an explanation for not having the affidavit is that the lawyers don't know. But in my experience is both ways. Sometimes the lawyers don't want to give an affidavit, and sometimes they fall on their sword unnecessarily to try and help their client. But there's no explanation given anywhere. I mean, he brought several collateral proceedings. I don't understand the collateral proceedings in California with several habeas corpuses, but he brought several collateral proceedings. And I just want to ask you one more question. I believe the driver in the ambulance testified that he took his medical history, and there was a list of the illnesses that he said he suffered from while he was being driven to the hospital. And in fact, it was accurate. In other words, you know, when Dixie testified, he didn't remember whether he gave those answers. But in fact, the testimony of the medic on the who drove to the hospital accurately reflected his medical history, which would suggest that he was fairly lucid.
Yes, Your Honor, there was mixed testimony because the first person on the scene described him as being non-responsive.
Well, the first person on the scene was just there immediately, you know, after this car stopped suddenly. But by the time he got into the ambulance, he apparently was lucid enough to provide his medical history.
And, Your Honor, there's also evidence in the record that he said he was HIV positive, which he's not. So there was mixed testimony.
Well, he said he wasn't. Who knows? Nobody was going to go. It was not really relevant to take a test of whether he was or he wasn't. But all I'm suggesting is that he appeared to be quite lucid in the ambulance right afterwards.
Your Honor, yes, the ambulance paramedic said that he was able to respond to the questions and gave those answers. The first medical person on the scene described him quite differently.
I understand that, but it seems to me the reason that the ambulance drivers is significant was because it accurately reflected that he had schizophrenia, and I don't remember the other collection of illnesses that he described. And somebody who, and he admitted, Dixie, that in fact he had those illnesses. Forget about the HIV for the moment. So somebody who was totally out of it and not lucid couldn't have given those answers.
At the time he was being driven in the ambulance, those were the answers that were.
Yeah, so he was not quite out of it.
At that time.
Yes,
although the testimony preceding that indicates he was unintelligible. So it is a mixed record, Your Honor. I do acknowledge that.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted.